Welcome back to Ghosts of Arlington, Episode 42, Project Mercury, Part 1.
Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear. The clock has started.
Five, 5, 4, 4, 3, 3, 2, 2, 1, 1.
Liftoff, we have a liftoff.
And how's that for the introduction of a series about space? I'm going to continue to use Liftoff by Kenny's voice for the duration of these space episodes. I know I tend to take a more somber tone with this podcast, but this is the space race. I think we can afford to get amped up a little. After publishing last week's episode, I made an arbitrary decision about the naming convention for this series. It was going to be the space race the whole way through, but I decided to break it up a little based on which era of the space race we are talking about. Last week covered a very brief history of space and took us to the initial days of the Cold War space race. The Soviet Union put the first two artificial satellites into orbit, followed by Laika, a dog, who was also put into orbit. Unfortunately for that good girl, there was never a plan to bring her home. Soviet success in space surprised the West, and the United States scrambled to catch up. After a few spectacular failures, the U.S. finally got its own satellite into orbit, Voyager 1, and introduced to the world the Mercury 7, the first class of NASA astronauts, one of whom NASA hoped would become the first person in space. But there was still a long way to go before that would become a reality, especially considering the rate at which U.S.-built rockets were failing, often explosively, when launched. On May 28, 1959, 10 days after the Mercury 7 personally witnessed the latest rocket failure and saw the most recent Atlas rocket explode over Cape Canaveral, Florida, Life magazine declared that America had two new space heroes. And unlike any of the Mercury 7, these two had actually been to space and safely returned. Abel, a female rhesus monkey, and Baker, a female squirrel monkey, were fished out of the ocean after surviving a 15-minute trip in space. In 1958, a male squirrel monkey, Gordo, also went into space and survived re-entry, but he and his capsule were unable to be recovered before sinking into the ocean and taking all of his data with him. Readings from Abel and Baker showed that their heart rate and respiration had remained normal during their several minutes of zero gravity, and post-flight physical exams showed they had not suffered any psychological side effects either. Admitting that it would be dangerous to extrapolate from monkeys to men, scientists could now reasonably hope that humans would fare as well as the monkeys had. This success did not provide NASA any breathing room. Before Abel and Baker went into space, the Soviets had launched two more dogs and safely brought them back this time, so they were also making progress in getting their first cosmonaut into space. After the excitement of the first few months of training, enhanced after the successful return of Abel and Baker, the Mercury 7 began to push back against their specific role. other test pilots, many of whom were undoubtedly jealous that they were not themselves selected as part of this astronaut program, began to joke that the astronauts were doing a job so simple that a trained monkey could do it. Test pilots were used to having complete control of the craft they were flying, but the space capsules were designed to go up and come back down all but autonomously, and most of the flight was managed by mission control back on Earth. Not only was that true, but engineers were also looking at removing the possibility of human error altogether, and went so far as to suggest that astronauts should be anesthetized or otherwise sedated before liftoff. Not only was this different than what the prospective astronauts had been told during the recruiting process, but it also led them to begin questioning why human lives would be risked if human control or interaction with the capsule wasn't needed. This emboldened the Mercury 7 to begin making demands. In late 1959, they went to engineers and insisted that a window be added to the Mercury capsule. They refused to accept that the best NASA could do, given concerns about the capsule's weight, was a periscope with a fisheye lens or a tiny porthole positioned so thoughtlessly that an astronaut had to crane his neck to see out of it. Without a proper window, the astronauts would, in effect, be flying blind, incapable of orienting the spacecraft visually if the automatic control system failed. He would also be unable, in John Glenn's words, to describe a sight that had been an ageless dream of humankind, the Earth from the heavens. They got their window, despite the cost and complication of the redesign, and they were able to get a little more control of their training schedule, working in a little free time, but they were no closer to getting control of the spacecraft itself. According to the astronauts, in the early days of their training, they were a close-knit group that got along well. Gordo Cooper went so far as to say they were like a bunch of brothers, but they were also all ambitious. Each knew that before long, one of them would be the first American, and hopefully the first person, in space. They spoke openly about teamwork, but did have moments of candor. Wally Schirra told Life magazine, "I want to be the first. The impact of being first is something that will be only yours for the rest of your life and on into history." Glenn was equally frank, saying, "Anyone who doesn't want to be first doesn't belong in this program." Each astronaut had his own set of public and private cheerleaders hoping to get their man into space first. But thanks to his already existing celebrity, every other member of the Seven identified John Glenn as their main rival for the first spot. The media also loved him. In his book Mercury Rising, Jeff Schiessel writes, "Compared with the others, Glenn was a pleasure to deal with, a willing interviewee, a source of good quotes. Shepard they found regal, cold, on edge. Schirra, wisecracking behind the scenes, was usually stiff in public, as were Grissom and Slayton. Carpenter and Cooper were more appealing, but their public personas were less fully formed." Before long, the others began to resent Glenn's ease with and affection from the reporters, especially during the press conference where the Seven first met the media. Schiessel continues, "The resentment hardened into ill will. Even decades later, the other astronauts came back again and again to that moment. While they had squirmed in their seats, Slayton complained late in life, 'Glenn ate this stuff up. Every question was cause for another damn speech about God and family and destiny.' To Cooper, who had found the day an ordeal and who feared that he had come across as a rube, Glenn was a hungry mountain lion that had just spotted dinner." They all thought Glenn was playing to the cameras and believed that during his fighter pilot days, Glenn had been just as foul-mouthed and irreverent as they still were. He had just reinvented himself after his record-setting flight that I mentioned last week. As John Glenn, the Boy Scout, the saintly Sunday school teacher, the aw shucks homespun hero. Those who knew Glenn during his Marine Corps days said that simply wasn't true. The John Glenn they saw now was the John Glenn they had always known. Despite the notion that Glenn was seeking out and hogging the spotlight to improve his chances of being selected first, he was also the first to vocally complain to NASA what all seven soon felt, that the press, who not only hounded the astronauts wherever they went, but also their families, had grown too distracting and was taking away from their time to train, to think, and to rest. The seven staged another minor rebellion and demanded that NASA, who, in the words of the astronauts, seemed to be running the space program as a public relations exercise, limit their press availability to one day a week. Just as they had with the capsule window, the seven prevailed. Despite this, the other six still refused to believe that Glenn was on their side. A lot of the astronauts' early training took place in Langley, Virginia, near Washington, D.C., where they found extracurricular activities harder to come by. But once they moved more permanently to Florida, near Cape Canaveral, they found plenty of ways to blow off steam. After 10 to 12 hours of grueling training a day, they would hop in their Corvettes, provided by a local dealer for the unbeatable price of $1 a year, and race off to Cocoa Beach, described by one journalist as a harlot of a town, to carouse. And carouse seems to be the appropriate term, at local motels and tiki bars. Many of the astronauts, all of whom were married, were openly unfaithful. Women were heard to say, "Four down, three to go," and that seems to be an accurate count. Glenn would accompany his colleagues to the Strip, but his refusal to even flirt distanced him even more from five of the other six, who labeled him a scold and a prude. From Glenn's point of view, their private lives were no longer private, and a major scandal involving the Mercury 7 might not end the space program, but could definitely end their involvement with it. Even after he brought up this point with his colleagues and they all conceded that he was probably right, there was still more extracurricular activity than he would have liked. In the end, it seemed that some kind of unspoken understanding arose between the seven and the press, who, despite being aware of what was going on around Cocoa Beach, never reported on it. A noticeable split had formed, with Scott Carpenter becoming an acolyte of sorts to John Glenn, while Cooper, Grissom, Shira, and Slayton more or less aligned with the hard-partying Alan Shepard. For their part, Glenn and Shepard began to stand out as the top two candidates to be first in space. In San Diego, while out on a West Coast tour of NASA engineering sites in September 1959, Glenn's fears came true. Shepard had gone down to Mexico, and while having a dalliance with a woman in Tijuana, a photographer snapped a compromising photo. A California newspaper reporter who had also been following Shepard wrote an article to accompany the snapshot, and an editor was intending to publish the story. This would be quite the contrast to the Life magazine cover the week before that highlighted the seven wives of the seven astronauts. Glenn had to intervene on his rival's behalf, making several phone calls and giving several of his patented John Glenn speeches, the kind he gave to the press corps or the House committee. This one, though, had an edge. The United States, Glenn said, was falling behind the quote-unquote godless communists. The press, he insisted, had to let us get back in the race, had to help America catch up. I pulled out all the stops, he recalled, and it worked. When he got the paper the next morning, he saw that it had not published the story. But Glenn's relief soon gave way to anger. He called an immediate emergency astronauts-only meeting and lit into his colleagues for repeatedly, habitually putting the mission in jeopardy. They had dodged a bullet, he said, because he had been there to clean up Shepard's mess. They had all worked too hard for themselves and their country to see it jeopardized by anyone who, quote, couldn't keep his pants zipped, end quote. Despite the close call, Shepard was unrepentant and insisted that everyone had the right to do what he wanted. To make matters worse, this time Carpenter sided with Shepard, which really irked Glenn, who later said, "My views were in the minority, but I didn't care. I had made my point." As author Jeff Schiessel wrote, he had indeed made his point, and it would cost him more than recklessness had cost Al Shepard. While the astronauts were in California, Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev was on a 13-day coast-to-coast tour of the United States that culminated with a meeting at Camp David with President Eisenhower. At Camp David, Khrushchev presented Ike with a five-sided medallion engraved with the sickle and hammer. The medallion was a replica of the one that just one day earlier, a Soviet spacecraft had delivered to the moon. The spacecraft, Lunik 2, had been traveling 75,000 miles, or about 121,000 kilometers per hour, when it hit the moon somewhere between the Sea of Tranquility and the Sea of Serenity. A soft landing was, for now, well beyond Soviet capabilities. Whether or not the medallion survived the impact was irrelevant. It was the first man-made object to touch the surface of the moon and had almost as huge a psychological impact on the American public as the launch of Sputnik had. Khrushchev used the moment to further jab the American president, intentionally referring to the medallion as a pennant, to give the impression that the Soviets had planted their flag on the lunar surface. He assured the American president that whenever American scientists finally got their own pennant to the moon, quote, "The Soviet pennant, as an old resident of the moon, will welcome your pennant, and they will live together in peace and friendship, as we both should live together on the earth," end quote. While U.S. politicians tried to laugh off the incident with remarks like, "Well, if the medallion did hit the moon, it probably vaporized on impact," another Atlas rocket exploded during a test launch, the third to explode during Khrushchev's two-week visit. The plan had been for one of these three rockets to get a U.S. satellite in orbit of the moon by the second anniversary of the Sputnik launch, and to welcome with fanfare what the Washington Evening Star was calling Year 3 of the Spectacular Space Age. But now there were no more backup rockets, so Year 3 was going to begin just as Year 1 had, with the Soviets celebrating and the Americans dejected. And celebrate the start of Year 3 the Soviets did. On October 4, 1959, the exact second anniversary of their first successful launch, Lunik 3 successfully photographed the far side of the moon, which had never been seen or studied. As Lunik 3 swept around the moon, the spacecraft stopped its rotation, held steady for 40 minutes while its two cameras took pictures, then flew back in the direction of Earth, transmitting the images to receivers on the ground. The photographs were blurry, but the display of proficiency was breathtaking. Experts began to wonder if the U.S. was 1 year or 1 decade behind the Soviet space program. It wasn't all doom and gloom, though. The Americans had sent twice as many satellites and probes into space than the Soviets had, and had been the first to transmit television images of Earth from space. On October 4th, as the Soviets were photographing the far side of the moon, NASA finally successfully launched a mock-up of a Mercury capsule. As one NASA administrator put it, Lunik 3 had left America no further behind than they were yesterday, but that's far enough. As 1959 turned into 1960, a young Democratic senator from Massachusetts began asking not what he could do for the space program, but what the space program could do for him. John F. Kennedy, who had never shown any interest in space and felt that any non-military purposed space research was a waste of money, began reaching out to trusted advisors and asking if he should change his mind. All of the advisors agreed that space exploration was important, but when pressed, they also admitted it was impossible to foresee for certain how detrimental it would be if the Soviets got a man into space first, or even if they got the first reconnaissance satellite. These advisors did seem to convince Kennedy that the risks of not challenging the Soviets for space supremacy would outweigh the risks of mounting a challenge and failing. "The most dangerous thing we can do," one advisor said, "is to underestimate the enemy." But first things first, before he settled on his space policy, JFK was focused on locking down the Democratic presidential nomination, which he did. When Lyndon B. Johnson emerged as Kennedy's vice presidential nominee, it was clear that the two would make space a campaign issue. The Republican nominee, Richard Nixon, was Eisenhower's vice president, and while Nixon was a great cheerleader of NASA, he was marked by Ike cutting NASA's budget as the Soviets were pulling ahead. After Kennedy was nominated, Ralph E. Lapp, a physicist who had been part of the Manhattan Project, encouraged the nominee to focus more on space, telling him if he did, Kennedy could lock up the election if the Soviets put a man in orbit before Election Day, which was only 3 months away. During the campaign, Kennedy shrugged off suggestions to outline his space policy, probably because he really didn't have a space policy, but he did make a quip at a campaign stop in Wichita, Kansas, that resonated with the American public and, in Kennedy's mind, gave them ample reason to vote the Republicans out of the White House they had held for the last 8 years. "Can you tell me," he shouted at an outdoor stadium, "how any citizen can vote for a political party and leadership which permits us to be second in space?" How to make America first in space could wait until after he won the election. At the beginning of 1960, there was hope in NASA that a manned spaceflight would be possible by the end of the year. But it soon became clear that wasn't realistic. NASA now hoped that they would be ready by the end of 1961. During the second half of 1960, the Mercury 7 continued training including a stint in Nevada for desert survival. They all said that spending a few days in the scorching desert was the worst part of their astronaut training, but there was a very small chance that a Mercury capsule re-entering Earth's atmosphere could crash land in either the Sahara or the Australian outback, as it would briefly pass over both locations. Though its direction from the Eisenhower administration was limited, NASA understood its way forward. When the space ambivalent Kennedy won the presidency in November 1960, the agency had no idea what to expect now. This is where we will pause our story today, but next week we will take a look at NASA in the Kennedy era and see what the newly elected president set as his administration's official space policy. If you have read ahead in the Project Mercury story, you might remember a very famous speech given in 1962 that had something to do with the moon. Since this is the last episode that will come out in the month of April, it also seems fitting that this should be where I make my last call for any questions you might like to ask about the show for the one-year anniversary episode that will come out toward the end of May. A big thank you to everyone who has reached out with questions so far, either via email at ghostsofarlingtonpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at ArlingtonGhosts, and on Facebook. Keep the questions coming. While this might be the last call, you have another week or two to get them in. And remember, fear not death, for the sooner we die, the longer we shall be immortal.